Welcome to Shift, a college admissions ACT and SAT podcast for a changing world. I'm Tyler, the founder of Achievable, and we have an affordable ACT course that includes everything you need to ace your ACT test. A full textbook, tons of ACT questions backed by our memory-enhancing algorithm, videos on key topics, a built-in study planner, and full-length practice exams. You can get a free trial by going to achievable.me and use the code PODCAST to get 10% off if you like it. Now, let's get started. Today, we've got Dave Lynch from StudyLark back on the show. And Dave, super excited to have you back. I'd love if you could just introduce yourself for people that haven't heard you before.
Sure. Thanks, Tyler. It's very nice to be back. So my name is Dave Lynch. I'm the founder of StudyLark Test Prep based in Philly. And I've been teaching test prep for a pretty long time, about 20 years. And I would say that my main focus is the LSAT for folks who are getting ready to go to law school, but I also do a pretty healthy amount of SAT and ACT tutoring as well. I've done all kinds of things, writing books and working for companies big and small across the country. But my main passion is just working one-on-one with students, and I've been doing that for a long time. So,
yeah, fantastic. Mm-hmm. And so today we're going to be talking about basically the different types of verbal questions on the digital SAT and also, you know, how to solve them, right? And I think that the what you said is you kind of put things in a priority order in terms of how they appear on the test. So that seems like a good order to go in here.
I was thinking chronological order, it's kind of predictable what students are going to see in terms of what order they show up in. There's always a little bit of variation from one test to the next, but students can kind of expect to see the same thing as they go.
Very cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd love if you could just, you know, where do you want to start, or what's kind of the first one you're going to see?
Sure. Yeah. So when students first open up their digital SAT, either on the real test or in the Blue Book practice app, the first thing that they'll see are what the SAT likes to call words in context questions. A lot of people refer to these as vocabulary or fill in the blank questions, and they're kind of what it sounds like. So you get some sentences, and for the most part, your job is to fill in a missing vocabulary word or choose the right word. Or there's a few cases in which they give you some old piece of text and they direct your attention to a certain word and ask you what it means in the context. So usually what people who are studying for the SAT first think about is, how do I get better at these? Should I study vocabulary? And the short answer, in my opinion, is no, you should not. In the old days, Tyler, you may remember, not on the like two versions of the SAT ago, there were also some fill-in-the-blank vocabulary questions. And for those, it actually was pretty effective to study vocabulary ahead of time. And the reason for that was that the SAT used the same words over and over, especially some hard and obscure vocabulary words that people often didn't know, but then could study and could expect to see on their test again. And I'm sad to say that I don't think that that works anymore. The SAT now uses kind of much more regular vocabulary, kind of day-to-day stuff where people are familiar with the words, but they might have five or six different definitions. And it's more about looking at the context of the passage to see which is the right definition to use of these words, as opposed to knowing obscure and repeated words.
Got it. Okay. So, and these are words that you would have hopefully learned kind of in your typical high school career. Is that the idea?
For the most part, I mean, there's because it's an adaptive test, the SAT can recognize if you have a really good vocabulary, and it can crank up the difficulty and find some words that are challenging for you. But most of the time, the challenge for these questions comes from looking at the context as opposed to knowing obscure words. And so if the approach here is not to study vocabulary words ahead of time, instead it's to make sure you have a really strong prediction before you get into the choices, because they should give you enough context in the passage to understand what the intended meaning is. In fact, they have to, otherwise there would be no basis for calling one answer right or another answer wrong. And so the main habit that people would just want to foster is practice these things and practice making predictions before you go look at the answer choices.
Yeah. And when you're making predictions, should those predictions be like, you know, oh, I predicted the word is going to mean hot, or I predicted the word is going to, or is it like more specific? Like, oh, I think that they're going to the word's going to be sweltering, right?
You don't need to get really specific in terms of what you think the actual word is. I think it's more important to get a general meaning, or even to recycle the contextual clues that are there in the sentence. So, and your prediction doesn't even have to be a single word. So, they might say, as opposed to studies that are directed in a specific direction, this study, blah, blah, blah. And if you were going to come up with a prediction in that case, you might come up with something that says not directed in a specific direction. And so that's a prediction. It's not a single word. There could be lots of different single words that carry that meaning. But as long as you have that meaning, which is informed by the contextual clues within the sentence, then you're open to whatever vocabulary word comes along and the choices and carries that specific meaning.
Right. Yeah, it makes a ton of sense. Anything else on this one, or are you ready to move on to the next one
I
that
think
you'll
that's one of
see?
the more simple ones. So
Yeah.
that's, yeah, not too much to say about those, I think.
Great. Well, then
So
what comes after that? What's the next thing?
after that, there's going to be a couple of questions that are probably the most similar to or most central to what you might think of as reading comprehension, where there's some text and you're reading it and your job is to comprehend it, make sure you understood what the author was saying. So the two sort of types there would be what's called, what the SAT calls text structure and purpose, and a second type called cross-text connections. And so these are going to be pretty similar or pretty familiar to people, I would say, just based on things that you've done in school and even previous versions of standardized tests, whether it's like state assessment tests or if you've taken the PSAT in past years or other, the old version of the SAT. It's reading and it's making sure that you understood what was said. The big difference here compared to the old paper SAT is that these texts are much shorter. So they're going to be just a few sentences or a paragraph as opposed to very long passages that people might remember from the old SAT.
Yeah, I think that's one of the biggest things that they did that people were happy about, right? Instead of getting
Yeah.
a big, a cluster of questions that are all centered around one passage, right? And you have to kind of go back and forth in that passage, and you got to like strategize how you're going to read it. And like now it's just like one question, one passage. The passage is usually a lot shorter. And it kind of simplifies that a bit.
Yeah, so the whole attention span thing is not as much of an issue. And sometimes what would happen on the old test was that people would read a long passage and miss out on one of the big ideas that the author said. And that still remains an issue, but these days, if you miss out what on the big idea of what the author said, that's going to cost you one question. On the old test, that could have cost you as many as 10 questions. So it's a little bit lower stakes in that way, but that doesn't mean that it's necessarily just an easier task overall. They're still, again, going to find a level of difficulty that's going to challenge you because it's an adaptive test, and there's nothing that says a short 3 to 4 sentence paragraph can't be difficult to read. They can certainly be difficult to read and comprehend. So a big part of what I advise people to do there is really take your time, right? So the clock is ticking. There's a little clock up on the screen, and it's easy to feel that time pressure. But they have constructed the test so that you do have enough time to read what you're given. And so for me personally, I often read that paragraph a couple of times, and that shouldn't be worrisome to students. That's, I think, what you need to do in order to really come up with a strong comprehension of what the author is saying.
Yeah, and I also think that it's just important to, I think because it's only one passage, one question too, you can kind of move on a little bit more quickly in general, like, because at the end of the day, it's really just one question, and it sometimes if you're struggling with something, you just need to cut your losses in general.
That's right. Yeah. Or come back to it. So, the digital SAT is nice because you can flag things. And in terms of section pacing, actually a lot of people we're talking about things in the forward order in the reading and writing section, but a lot of people will actually work on the section in kind of a backwards order because, as we'll hear later, the questions in the back of the section are usually a little bit faster and more based on grammar rules as opposed to reading. And so sometimes people want to save the reading ones for last so that they know exactly how much time they can afford to budget to each particular question at the end.
Got it. Cool. That's a good tip. Yeah, so then what comes after the reading comprehension questions?
Yeah, so after the reading comes some questions that are much more based on logic, and these are near and dear to my heart because they very much remind me of the LSAT. So the SAT has added some questions that they call command of evidence. There's kind of a textual variety, command of textual evidence, and then also a quantitative variety in which you're looking at charts and graphs. And maybe we can kind of lump these in with what they also call inference questions. But for all of these types, it goes beyond just seeing what somebody has written and understanding it. Instead, you have to get involved now. So a really common type of question in terms of the command of textual evidence would be that somebody has made an argument, and it could be either a scientific argument or a literary argument, making a claim about a particular author's writing style or something like that. And that claim is out there. It may have a little bit of supporting evidence, but you need to do something either to make that claim stronger or in some little bit rarer cases to make that claim weaker. And you would do that by introducing additional evidence into the passage that was going to have some kind of effect on the logic. So this may be a little bit of a less familiar task for SAT students because I don't know how much of this people do in school. It's certainly less, I think, than just straight up comprehending what you read. But the good news, I think, for these is more so than the question types that we've talked about before. You can there's more techniques that can be involved. So things that have to do with breaking down arguments, looking at the logical structure in which they work, thinking about flaws in reasoning, and thinking about how you could patch up that flaw in reasoning or attack that flaw in reasoning or, and you know, stay focused on the author's claim and things like that. So I'm actually pretty excited to talk about this type of question with students because, like I said, it just reminds me of something that I've been doing for many years on the LSAT. And if that sounds scary to people, the good news is it's a very much watered down version of the test that people are taking to go to law school. But it's still kind of cool. I think it's a little bit of a challenging, but an interesting way of approaching this kind of verbal content. So,
yeah, I mean, are you willing to dig in on this? Because I think this is one of the more interesting ones that has come up. And it is, like you said, it's kind of new with the new digital SAT. Mm-hmm. You mentioned kind of three things, which is breaking down arguments, structure, and then flaws in reasoning. And I'd love to maybe start by kind of going through those and how to kind of approach each part.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So every one of these command of evidence questions is going to have some kind of claim that somebody made. I'll try to restrain comparing it too much to the LSAT, but on the LSAT they actually often try to disguise what the claim is, but on the SAT they're pretty transparent about it. They'll just say somebody has made a claim of XYZ, and it's almost always the last part of the passage, or sometimes even underlined for you, so that they're really not trying to disguise the claim. They're directing your attention toward it. But then what that means is that the components of the passage that you're reading kind of fall into two different categories. There's the claim itself, and then there's the supporting evidence that has been provided for the claim. And those two types of information occupy two different logical categories. So if something is functioning as supporting evidence, then your job is to take it as true, take it as something that you want to understand and accept, but not really argue with. On the other hand, the claim is something that is up for debate or it is not yet fully proven. It's the kind of thing that someone might try to take issue with. And so at least understanding just the rules of how to break down the two different types of information that they give you is really important so that you're like, you know, playing by the rules of the test.
Right. Well, and so that you're focusing on the right thing, which is the claim and not like the supporting evidence.
Yeah. So the claim is really your target. Like that's where your action is directed. But you can't ignore the supporting evidence because the whole reason that the claim needs additional supporting, or in the cases where you're trying to weaken it, why it can be weakened, is that the supporting evidence did a somewhat okay job of providing, like bolstering or support for that, but not a perfect job. And so a big part of this is thinking through the relationship between the supporting evidence and the claim that's being made, and thinking of how that supporting evidence does a good job but not a perfect job. So where are the problems? Did they potentially have a study that didn't investigate a potential confounding factor, or did the author possibly confuse a correlation with a causal relationship? And can we introduce additional evidence that would rule out a correlation and prove that it's more of a causal relationship or something like that? And so I think a big part of this, once again, is knowing what you're looking for before you get into the answer choices. Because if you've just read everything and you're like, okay, that's nice, let's go read the choices, and you're not goal focused, or you're not oriented towards finding something that you've thought through ahead of time, then I think you're kind of at a disadvantage when you get into the choices, because you don't really have any reason for picking one choice over another. You don't have a goal in mind.
Yeah, so when you're reading these, are you trying to like would you recommend, because in for instance on the ACT, like one of the kind of important reading comp strategies is to like annotate the page and like highlight it and stuff, and like circle names or circle like key things that you think are important. Do you feel like that's kind of the same approach you want to take with these, or how else would you kind of like tactically approach this?
A lot of annotation is, I think it's a personal issue for different students. Some students are just used to doing that on a regular basis in the course of their studies and other tasks that they approach in an academic setting, and others don't do any of it at all. I'm one of the people who makes zero annotations on anything and basically never takes any notes, but I don't pretend that my way of approaching things is representative of everybody. So I usually say whatever you're kind of used to. But in comparison to the ACT or the old SAT, I think making a lot of annotations is going to play less of a factor in the digital SAT. And for maybe two main reasons. One is that the passages are just shorter. So do you need to write a summary of a three sentence paragraph? I mean, it's probably much more likely that you'll be able to hold those three sentences in your working memory without having to write them down.
Totally.
Perhaps there could be some advantage to writing something down just as a way of distilling your thoughts or making sure that you grasped what the author said. So there could be a role for that. But the second reason why the annotation might play less of a role is that it's more of a pain on the digital SAT than it is on a paper test. So you can do things like highlight and underline, or even there's a small box for typing annotations. But I personally have found it kind of difficult to use. Students could also use their scrap paper for making annotations and things like that, but that again is going to require them to do kind of like switch their focus from a screen to a piece of paper, which can cause its own difficulties. So I think the main reason is it's less information, so it's probably going to be less of a challenge to hold it in your working memory.
Got it. Yeah. Any other kind of tips on how to tackle this problem type, right? Maybe with like the sort of reasoning portion a little bit, right? Because that is new, and that is the part that I maybe think that high school students will not be as used to. I mean, even me, when I took the GMAT, which is a graduate school admissions exam, I found that the sort of logical reasoning part was much on the quant section, so the math, but that part was a lot harder than the math itself.
Yeah, that's true. And yeah, some of those graduate tests, even the GMAT and the GRE and the LSAT, have kind of things in common. And I think that indicates that it's a skill that has some utility later in your academic career and in life as well. But I think it takes like kind of digging into going through a lot of practice questions and looking for some advice in terms of specific strategies for that stuff for students. It might not be quite as automatic or intuitive or in line with things that they've previously done in school. So,
yeah. Do you have any other strategies on that that you wanted to share? We kind of cover everything.
Not in the time that we have. I think it really gets deep. If I was going to maybe sum it up in one thing, it might be to, again, make sure that you've come up with a prediction before you get into the choices. So it's not one of these where, and that's really been the common theme for all of the reading comprehension types that we've talked about so far. The vocabulary, you got to know what you're looking for before you get into the choices. If they ask you what's the purpose or the main idea of the text, you got to know that answer before you look at the choices. And for the reasoning questions as well, you got to know what you're looking for before you get into the choices.
Got it. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. All right, so we've gone through a few question types at this point. Which one is next, and how many do we have left also?
Well, so not too many. At this point, it kind of transitions over to like the grammar side of things.
Right.
And so this, in a way, it's a little bit like the old, actually not a little bit, it's very similar to the content that was being tested on the paper SAT. So there's a kind of a few that you could maybe lump together. There's the straight up grammar questions, which would either be what the SAT calls boundaries questions, or they have a very fancy name called form, structure, and sense. I don't know why they have to use such a strange sounding name for these, but it's things like apostrophes and semicolons and subject verb agreement and pronoun agreement and misplaced modifiers and things like that. So for those, what do you do? It's all about knowing your grammar rules inside and out. And this is probably the easiest place to pick up some points for a student on a test because number one, it's probably something that people have talked about, but I find that it was often a big topic of conversation for people in the sixth grade, and then they haven't talked about it since in a lot of cases. And so it's going to be familiar rules, also things that you just encounter in regular academic writing. And so none of it should be too foreign to people. But if you need to brush up on your use of dashes and semicolons and apostrophes, and misplaced modifiers, that's usually the kind of thing that can be pretty quick. So that would be like the grammar side of things. And the other kind of question that is very similar to what they used to ask about on the old paper SAT is what they call transitions questions. And this is not so much grammar exactly, but it's more about using words like however and therefore and nevertheless and consequently and things like that to connect ideas within short paragraphs. So those questions or that idea was tested on the old SAT, and that has continued, but now no longer is it in the context of longer passages. Now it's just within shorter paragraphs.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I know with the ACT, just because I've read through our course on it, that like there's just kind of a bunch of rules that you want to memorize regarding like periods and semicolons and conjunctions and stuff like that. And, you know, if you kind of have those memorized, like these are almost free points. Do you feel like it's the same with the new digital SAT?
Yeah, very much so. All the rules that are tested on the digital SAT were tested on the old SAT and are tested on the ACT. I think you're right. those really should be pretty automatic. And those are like
the automatic. If you do the work ahead of time, you still definitely shouldn't go in being like, oh, I remember sixth grade grammar and just like not study it. Like definitely go over it. Cause you never know what little, there's some like little weird edge cases in English kind of throughout English. So you should always double check.
Yeah. Those happen for sure. Again, you know, they can find difficult versions of semicolon questions. And as you said, the funny edge cases, but I think what's sort of interesting is that I think they've even narrowed down the range of topics from the old SAT to the digital SAT in terms of the grammar topics that they test. So it should be even more accessible for students who want to just master everything that they're likely to see on the test.
Do you know what they like? What is different? Like, you mentioned this kind of like they've narrowed it down. Do you know what they cut or anything like that? If not, it's not
one of the deal. One of the things that they seem to have cut would be making logical comparisons. So, for example, if you had a sentence that said, the climate in Spain, like California, is characterized by, you know, hot summers and dry winters. That would be an illogical comparison because you're comparing the climate in Spain to California. In other words, you're comparing a climate to a place. And so to fix that, they would want you to use the word the word that. So the climate in Spain, like that in California. That seems to be gone, that logical comparison thing. I have a list somewhere of other things that are gone. It's not coming to mind right now, some of these other things, but
yeah, no, it's all good. I mean, you've already covered a lot of really helpful tips. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So then I'm curious. So after those grammar questions, you mentioned that people like to skip to the end to try and do those first. Are there any other question mm-hmm. types? And then otherwise, maybe we should just talk about whole section strategy.
Yeah. There's one last question type. In terms of automatic points, I think these should maybe be the very easiest on the whole test. And so what they do, again, the SAT has a funny name, which they call rhetorical synthesis, but you'll know them when you see them because what they do is they give you some notes that a student has taken when researching a topic, and it's presented in bullet point form. And then they'll say, now the student wants to write a sentence that accomplishes a certain thing. And for example, like emphasizes the difference in the length between the two bridges or something like that. And then the choices give you four possible sentences, and you have to choose the one that accomplishes the goal that the student is trying to achieve. So the really funny thing about those, and I think everyone I've talked to, all the different tutors I've talked to have kind of agreed, is that you can answer those without reading the bullet point notes that the student has taken, which is kind of shocking that the SAT would come up with a question like this. But the whole key to those questions is just staying very focused on the goal or the task that the student is trying to accomplish. And there's only going to be one sentence that could even possibly accomplish that task, even if you have no idea what the topic is that is described in the bullet point notes that the student has taken. And like, I want to be careful about this because I don't want to give advice that's going to lead people astray. And so in my kind of research and writing of materials for this new version of the test, I specifically forced myself to answer every single question I encounter, whether it's on a practice test or other source of information that the College Board has, or other source of questions that the College Board has released. I'm very disciplined to try every single time to cover up those bullet notes and answer the question without having read them. And I have not gotten a single question wrong doing it that way yet. So I think it's pretty safe to say that it certainly can be done, but the big thing to stay focused on is that make sure you don't forget about the task that you're given.
That makes a lot of sense. And yeah, it's just so interesting how they've chosen to kind of change different things about this test, right? The bullet points one, I mean, it's funny because that's like a kind of a real skill now. I mean, I use bullet points to communicate all the time because I just find it to be a format that really makes it easier to digest like a lot of things at once. But to see it on a standardized test is kind of a crazy thing for me.
We're living in a new world now. But so this is analogous to a task that shows up on the ACT too. So on the ACT, you know, you're reading a longer essay that a student has written, and then midway through the essay, they'll give you a question that says, you know, a student wants to write a sentence that does a certain thing, and which of these sentences accomplishes that thing. And so once again, you're just staying very focused on the actual task at hand, and there's really only going to be one option that even comes close to accomplishing that task. And so just don't get distracted by other things that might sound like well-written sentences or might sound like what
you would say in that situation, those considerations are irrelevant. Just focus on the task. They look a little different, but those questions at the very back of the SAT reading and writing section, I think, are very closely analogous to that type of question.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes a ton of sense. So now that we've kind of covered all the question types, do you want to talk at all about section strategy? Just, I thought that the idea of going backwards is kind of intriguing. Anything else you want to cover on that?
That's probably the main one. And the reason behind that is that I think the questions in the second half are faster. So you have your, you know, picking between a semicolon, a colon, and a comma, that kind of thing, which should be quick. And you have the bullet point ones that we just talked about. Those should be pretty quick because you don't need to read the bullet points. And so if you're doing the kind of grammar questions first, then what that allows you to do is perhaps pace yourself better when you get to the reading questions. You can see where you are in the section. You can see how much time you have remaining and how many questions you have remaining. And then you can say to yourself, oh, you know, this particular passage, even though it's short, it was very hard to understand. So do I have time to read it a second or a third time? Or do I need to just put something and move on? And it sort of allows you to budget your time better. Another sort of consideration there is that the questions in the first half of the section really do take longer simply because they have more words to them, and because it's a little bit more deep thinking in terms of like the reasoning strategies and things like that. And so often people will be doing those, if they do the questions in order, then they're going to be using a greater than average amount of time for the early questions, and they don't realize that the later questions will take them a less than average amount of time, and they think that they're falling behind the pace that they need to be going at, and so they'll start rushing. Yeah. And in fact, they're not falling behind the pace. It's just, it's going to get faster later in the section. And so, you can kind of head off some of that panic maybe by just doing them in the reverse order, doing the quick ones first.
Great.
It's also worth keeping in mind, I'm not sure if I would necessarily, do too much reorganizing of the questions, because of this phenomenon, but within a particular question type, they're going to be arranged from easy to hard. So if we're just talking about, for example, command of textual evidence questions, a student might encounter, you know, three or four of those. And the first one or two are going to be easier than the later ones. And so if you really wanted to get fancy, I suppose you could, you would want to do them in the order of difficulty, but just keep that in mind that things are going to be switching around. So like if you wanted to do the first two and then in the interest of time, move on to the next one or two of the next question type, then you could sort of like cherry pick the easy questions. But that might be a little bit too much overthinking it in terms of like jumping around too much within the section. But it's
a thing you can consider. Yeah. I think that it's particularly because it's not like they have like little chapter titles over each type of question, right? Like unless you're really, really confident with your ability to diagnose question types, which would already kind of put you in like the top quartile of test takers, right? So if you're a really good test taker and you're trying to get an 800, then like maybe you can try that. But otherwise, don't worry. Don't overthink it too much.
In which case, if you're trying for that perfect score, then you're going to be doing every question anyway. So you might as well do them in order, or at least not be trying to outsmart yourself by reorganizing them too much.
Cool. That's all great. Thank you so much. Anything else before we wrap up?
Not too much. I mean, I think you mentioned people being very strong with diagnosing the question type. And actually, that is something that I emphasize with my students, because I think all these different questions have different strategies associated with them. And so I think it is important to at least read the stem first before you read the passage, so that you could say, oh, this is a grammar question, or this is a main idea question, or this is a strengthening question, because it at least like gets you pointed in the right direction. So being familiar with the types, it's not just a fun categorization exercise for tutors, but I think it does have a meaningful makes a meaningful difference for students in the middle of the test as well. So I would encourage people to kind of get familiar with those different pieces, be able to recognize them, and know what to do for each one.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. This has been Shift, a college admissions podcast for a changing world, hosted by Tyler from Achievable with Dave Lynch from StudyLark. And you can get a free trial of Achievable's ACT course by going to achievable.me and use the code podcast to get 10% off if you like it.